Big Show kicking off November. Friday, November 1st, we talk to a distinguished professor from Clemson University regarding his book that looks at the American Revolution and the gentleman who orchestrated that from a completely new perspective. Professor Alan Sanders joined us from St. Peter's University in Jersey City, New Jersey, to talk about what's going on with impeachment, where we are in that process right now. Bridgeport Mayor Joe Ganim stopped by to talk about his reelection campaign and his reaction to a recent court decision regarding absentee ballots and the Bridgeport Democratic mayoral primary. And we wrap the show up with Stratford GOP State Senator Kevin Kelly and his weekly update. Just get out and vote all over the state of Connecticut coming up Tuesday night. And Bridgeport Mayor Joe Ganim joins us right now. And we want to get his thoughts first on the court decision yesterday from the judge. Mayor, it's Paul. How are you, sir?
What do you mean? You don't think the candidates for municipal election were not sexy? Why not?
Well, it just...
I use sexy in a little...
I can't get in trouble here, Mayor. You know what I'm talking about?
I'm trying to get you in trouble. That's what I'm
Listen, if it boosts my paycheck, that's fine. No, seriously, Mayor, you know, Judge Stevens, he ordered the election to go on yesterday, but he did have some pretty pointed things to say in his opinion. What do you think of that?
Well, one, I want to thank the court for spending a lot of time. I mean, this was not a quick, easy, I don't know if it was hard or easy as far as the substance of it, but the judge took a lot of time, a lot of the court time, and the lawyers worked hard on this, and I think a lot went into making sure that a thorough and proper decision, 21 pages, by the way, was issued by the court. So I want to applaud Judge Stevens, really, for doing that. And I think with that, certainly we thought we were going to win from the beginning, and we thought it should have been quick. But the fact that he took the time, I think, adds confidence to the amount of time, effort, and deliberations that went into to the conclusions. And to that end, obviously the big takeaway is two things. And one is that the over 10,000 people that cast their ballots in the Democratic primary for mayor in the city of Bridgeport on September 10th, that that's being respected, that their will, their right to the election and to predict and to be a part of selecting the Democratic nominee was honored by the court. And two, that there's going to be an election that goes forward on this Tuesday, November 5th. I think that's critically important for people to remember. This is where they actually will elect the next mayor and city council, et cetera, for the city of Bridgeport for the next 4 years. And you've heard my pitch that if you want, you want us to keep your taxes down, which we will, and you want more money for education and public safety, then let's keep going. We have more work to do. Certainly, it's a far from perfect job. As far as what the judge said about some specifics, I read his opinion, very well written. And what he said was, in this process, this where you have to fill out these applications that are very technical, is something the legislature should look at. Other states have things called early voting, where people can, by right, without filling out a specific reason as required in Connecticut, can have the ability, if they can't get to the polls that day, to vote. And I think that's important. What we all want to do is, what this lawsuit tried to do, unfortunately, was disenfranchise, especially seniors, some of our most vulnerable, handicapped, and people don't have access to transportation to get out and vote. So I want to remind people that I stand for the right to vote against disenfranchising under any grounds, whatever it is. And thanks to the judge for his hard work on this.
Mayor, he mentioned a couple of things. He said he wants the General Assembly to take a look at this. He doesn't like the fact, as you say, that Connecticut doesn't have no excuse absentee ballots. He alluded to having fewer people, if I read his language correctly, actually handle these things, have hands on it, streamlining the process. Would you be in favor of all that?
100%. We've been advocating for that for years. And not what they've tried to do, which is, you know, I hate to keep using these words, disenfranchised. So here's the situation. And I've been to talk to these residents, these voters. And they're like, yeah, we want to vote, regardless of who they want to vote for. And I say, can you make it to the polls? They say, look, I feel good today. I'm such and such years old. I have a situation. And they'll describe their physical or even it could be a mental situation, but usually physical. Mm-hmm. They'll say, I feel good today. Yeah, I could go vote. But maybe that day comes, they say, I don't know how I'm going to feel that day. Monday I feel good, Tuesday I can't leave the house, literally. So what do you say to that person who wants to vote?
Yeah.
Under our present system, someone could put a question mark next to them after the fact. So I don't want that person to lose their right to vote, whether it's for me, and certainly I hope I've earned their vote, but for whomever they want to vote. Well, this is democracy. This country, one of the founding principles is that right to vote. Vote us in, vote us out, but you have that right to vote. I don't want someone, after they hit a certain age or they have a physical disability in the state of Connecticut, to be denied that vote either intentionally or unintentionally. So it's very important. Very important. I think the best thing people could do over the next few days, focus on who the candidates are. Certainly, I'm in large part a known quantity, but I think I've been more emphatic on some of the things I stand for, as I've said before. Lowering taxes, more money for education, for public safety. We're paving streets all over the city. We want to do more. We've got $1 billion of investment coming in. So make a decision, and the best thing people can do is let their voices be heard and come out and vote on Tuesday in the city of Bridgeport.
Mayor, were you surprised, disappointed? Did your eyebrows go up when the Connecticut Post and Hearst Media endorsed Marilyn Moore a couple of days ago?
Well, they've kind of taken an approach that whatever we do in city government is probably not good enough. It's been a very difficult relationship over the past couple months. I hope that we can work towards with every business that has anything to do with the city of Bridgeport, especially the media. We want to improve the relationship, so I'm going to work on my part on doing that. There were some issues, as you know, with a reporter and a protest, and I think that kind of made it even more difficult. So, I wasn't surprised about the endorsement. I think I was a long shot. They didn't endorse me 4 years ago either, and so it didn't surprise me.
Yeah, we're here on a Friday. A few more minutes with Bridgeport incumbent Democratic Mayor Joe Ganim running next week on Tuesday in the Bridgeport municipal election against Don Rodriguez and Marilyn Moore, who's going to be running a write-in campaign now. Mayor, if you are to win again next week and have another four-year term, would you be open to taking input, ideas, and suggestions from Ms. Moore and her supporters?
Yeah, I think I've been saying since the beginning of whatever this campaign cycle is, for anyone who has something substantive to add to what can be accomplished in the city of Bridgeport, that I welcome that input. And I frankly hope to hear more information, positive ideas, and even constructive criticism from the candidates. And I've heard nothing from my opponents, nothing except, you know, we got into this where you, on a primary loss, just complaining about the loss, and people forget, you know, you win and you lose in elections. I've won elections, I've lost elections, and you go, you move on and hopefully support the winner. But more important than the winning and losing and the personalities is putting together the pieces that we need to improve the quality of life in our public school system, adding more funding there so that we can have smaller classroom sizes, a better student-teacher ratio. We could have better metrics on graduation rates, percentage of students that go on to college, and reducing dropout rates, and a capital improvement program for the schools while we build the police force and community policing to ensure public safety in every neighborhood, not just the perception, but perception and reality. So if any ideas on that. Now, we've got $1 billion of investment going on.
Mm-hmm.
Some of it is moving long, rapid pace, like the outdoor amphitheater. The steel's coming out of the ground there. You can see the boat docks along Steel Point where the new Boca restaurant, and if you've ever been there, it's a little pricey, but it's just a gorgeous venue, a gorgeous location. And in the west end, when you come in from Fairfield, all those old factories that were sitting there empty with broken windows are now replaced and have loft-style housing and an educational institution and retail. And even the list goes on, moving a little slower, but moving nonetheless is the Polite and Majestic Theater. So that stuff's going, but more can and additional things should be added to the repertoire to build the tax base so we can cut taxes, which I plan on doing again next year. And then we can have more money for education with a level of accountability from the Board of Ed. And public safety remains a top priority in every neighborhood. So if they've got ideas and they want to be a part of it in one way or another, I think that'd be great. Unfortunately, I got one of my opponents has got a record in Hartford of voting for increased taxes. cutting spending to Bridgeport schools, giving money to other towns, voting for a casino for East Windsor, but you know, been against the casino for Bridgeport when it means jobs and more money to reduce taxes. So you got a clear contrast. People are saying, hey, wait a minute, why would you be a legislator from Bridgeport and be against a job creator like a casino for Bridgeport's waterfront and before they're in favor of one someplace else, or for giving more money to a city like Waterbury and Hartford, a city that needs, but not for your own city, not for us in Bridgeport. So that's kind of what I've been getting so far.
Well, Mayor, thanks. We appreciate it. We know you're busy, and we will chat in the future, perhaps. Thanks, Mayor. Appreciate it.
Look forward to it. Thanks.
Thanks. Bye-bye. There you go. All right. Mayor Joe Gannon, we gave him room for a final pitch here. We had John Rodriguez on last week, and hopefully we can hook up with Marilyn Moore on Monday. We have extended the same chunk of time to Marilyn Moore coming up this Monday, and there you go. All right, what'd you think? 203-333-9422, 333-WICC, the mayor admitting there, yeah, things have been testy in the campaign, but he's ready, he thinks, for another four-year term. Obviously, Mr. Rodriguez and Ms. Moore think otherwise. It's going to be interesting to see if, in fact, Marilyn Moore can win a write-in campaign. It has been done before in the state, but that remains be seen. So once again, Election Day coming up on Tuesday. Please remember to get out and vote, no matter whom you are voting for in what city or town. I know, once again, as the mayor agreed with me, not all these races, you know, your first selectman, your town council, your RTM, sometimes not as sexy as Congress or the presidency, but in a lot of ways, more important on an everyday basis and how things affect you.
You're listening to Connecticut Today with Paul Pacelli on WICC 600.
And for that, we richly and dearly thank you. We're at 203-333-9422, 333-WICC. Paul Pacelli here, Aaron Johnson on the other side of the glass. We'll go back to open phones in a few minutes. Wanted to welcome, though, an interesting gentleman with a new interesting book caught my eye. And the book is being referred to by some people as a counterpoint to a new maybe mode of thinking here, or a new trendy piece, a trendy study that's been done by the New York Times called the 1619 Project. And as a juxtaposition on that, we have the book America's Revolutionary Mind, A Moral History of the American Revolution and a Declaration that Defined It. From Clemson University, it is Professor C. Bradley Thompson joins us on Connecticut Today. Professor Thompson, great to have you on the air here in Connecticut. How are you, sir?
Hi, Paul. Great to be with you.
What made you do this? Apparently, it's being billed, at least from what I read here, as a reinterpretation of the American Revolution. Don't we already know what started this, or do we need to peel back the layers again on this?
Oh, I think we absolutely need to peel back the layers. The American Revolution, not surprisingly, is probably the most written about subject in American history. And a number of years ago, I read a book by a Harvard professor on the Declaration of Independence that I thought was simply wrong and insulting to its audience about the Declaration of Independence. So I decided my own book on the Declaration. And in the process of writing the book, I came to the realization that we actually really don't know the deepest causes of the American Revolution. So there are scores of books on the political, constitutional, social, military history of the American Revolution. But I read a passage by John Adams in a letter that he wrote to Thomas Jefferson, where he asked the question, what do we mean by the revolution? And he said, it's not the war. That's not what the revolution. The real revolution, he said, was in the minds of the people, and that was 15 years before the first shots were fired at Concord and Lexington. And that made me start thinking that we really just don't understand the revolution's deepest causes. And to do that, we have to understand the moral causes of the American Revolution. And there is no book that's ever been written on the American Revolution that takes that perspective, that views the revolution as really a moral conflict between American colonists and British imperial officials. And so I think that's what makes the book new, and indeed even revolutionary in the context of other books that have been written on the revolution. And as you began this segment, I think it's also useful to view this book in contrast to the so-called 1619 Project of the New York Times, which I think is a total bastardization of American history. The argument that America was founded not in 1776 but in 1619, I think, is simply wrong and is promoting an ideological agenda. And so it turns out the publication of my book, I think, is perfect timing and can be read in contrast to this project of the New York Times.
Why do you think there is this, Professor, this revisionist, as you called it, history going on? The Times saying that, and the reason they chose 1619 is because they equate the beginning of this country with slavery. Why do you think they do that?
Well, because I think they ultimately, I think they're nihilists, and they want to make the American founding a founding in sin. They want to argue that America was founded in sin, and therefore America is an illegitimate nation or founded illegitimately. And then they also want to connect America to, and slavery, the sin of America, to capitalism. And so that they're promoting an ideological agenda. And this is not a historical project that they're undertaking. It's an ideological political agenda. And my book is meant to be a reinterpretation of the American Revolution, and to try to get both the facts right and the meaning of the revolution right.
Professor, if somebody just turned us on right now, they may have heard you say, well, the true meaning of the American Revolution, and here you're promoting your new book, and we have you on here. And would you be surprised if somebody, Professor, said, oh, come on, another book about the revolution? We've studied this over and over again. It's been studied by, you know, thousands of qualified historians, including yourself. And what don't we really know about this? What would you say to that person?
It's a reasonable question, and it's indeed a question that I myself would have asked just a couple of years ago before I started writing this book. Thomas Jefferson once said of the Declaration of Independence that it was an expression of the American mind. And in addition to the Adams quotation that I shared with you a minute ago, the Jefferson question really sort of set me off on a kind of intellectual journey to understand what he meant by this notion of the Declaration being an expression of the American mind. And I think what it means is that it's the Declaration and the four self-evident truths that it promotes is a kind of summing up of the American mind in 1776 and the process of thinking and the ideas, the self-evident truths that it developed over the course of those 15 years described by John Adams. So the subtitle of the book is It's a Moral History of the American Revolution. And there has not ever been a moral history ever written about the Declaration. And a moral history is one that views the conflict between the American colonists and British imperial officials through the prism of morality, which means it seems to me that the deepest conflict between Americans and the British during this period concerned the deepest and most fundamental questions concerning subjects such as justice, liberty, rights, equality. And over the course of that 15-year period, the Americans came to develop an entirely new and revolutionary understanding of all of those concepts. And so by the time we get to 1776, they have rejected all of the core ideas and institutions of ancien regime Europe, and have developed an entirely new and revolutionary philosophy, which, and this is the key point, which they then actually put into action.
Clemson University professor of political philosophy, C. Bradley Thompson, back with us. The name of his new book, an interesting one, America's Revolutionary Mind, a Moral History of the American Revolution and the Declaration that defined it. And Professor Thompson, are the people that might not agree with your book, the people who are holding high this 1619 project, would they argue with you then that none of these founders like Jefferson and Roger Sherman and Ben Franklin and John Adams and all these people could have had morals because they lived and worked in a time of slavery?
Well, they might argue that, but the truth of the matter is considerably more complicated. So many of the founding fathers, of course, not only did not own slaves, mm-hmm. they were adamantly opposed to it. And indeed, there's a whole range of views amongst the founding generation. Some had slaves and then released their slaves and became leaders of the abolitionist or anti-slavery movement. Some of them, like George Washington, had slaves but then released them upon their death. And then, of course, then there are some who did not, to their very great shame. But the bottom line is this. Every single American founding father was deeply morally opposed to the to the institution of slavery. And the single most important thing to know is that it was the Declaration of Independence, which is the single most important document in the liberation and emancipation of slaves in the United States. The Declaration established the moral foundation on which the subsequent anti-slavery and then abolitionist movement could lead the charge to end this stain on American history.
The correspondence between some of the people you talk about in this book, I've always found that aspect of what these guys said back at that time fascinating. What are your feelings on what you were able to read, to glean, to look into of how they talked and related to themselves regarding this morality that you talk about?
Well, I would say the first thing to note is that they actually really did take their own moral views deeply seriously. So they were not arguing against the Stamp Act or the Townsend or the Tea Acts, for instance, all of these acts of the British Parliament taxing them out of economic interests. They were deeply opposed to them on moral grounds, that they violated their rights. And in their correspondence, they make it very clear that in order to uphold the moral principles that they believe in, that they would have to act to oppose the greatest military power in the history of the world. And at the very end of the Declaration of Independence, the last line says that they are the signers of the Declaration are dedicated to sacrificing their lives, their fortunes, and their sacred honor to the cause of the revolution. And what comes out of their letters is a genuine and sincere support of the principles of the revolution. So they really meant what they said. They didn't just talk the talk. They walked the walk.
And obviously, as you say, and I think this is the key part of your book, if I'm getting this, is these were not decisions strictly made on dollars and cents and military strategy. I mean, they all had a means to an end. But the bottom line is these are guys who did, with all the faults they had back then, the conditions they grew up in, these are guys who based all of this, Professor, you're saying, on a moral foundation of what they thought ultimately was the right thing to do, not from a dollar and cent standpoint, but the right thing to do of being a human being. Is that what you're saying?
That's exactly what I'm saying. They worked out over the course of this 15-year period from 1760 to 1775, in their confrontation with the British over the Stamp Act and the Townshend Act, et cetera, et cetera, the actions of the British forced them to really seriously and deeply rethink the fundamental moral premises of their lives and of their relationship with the British Empire. And during that process, during the search for the most fundamental concepts of morality, justice, virtue, rights, liberty, etc., they developed a new moral code, in a sense, which they then, unlike many politicians that we have today, they put those ideas, they put those moral principles into practice.
And I would assume, Professor, that the way this is taught today, and I've been a good few years out of college but and high school, I'm still a voracious reader and listener of books around this period. So what you did comes as no surprise at all, and I'm glad you did. I would hazard to think, though, and maybe I'm wrong, and hopefully I would be, that this would be taught from this angle that you've come up with here, that it would be taught in schools. However, in today's environment, I somehow doubt that. What do you think?
Well, obviously my hope is that my book and the ideas contained therein would be taught, but I understand that the education establishment and the intellectual elite in this country probably would not support my understanding and presentation of the principles of the American founding. Mm-hmm. But I do believe that ideas have consequences, and that the only way to change bad ideas is to come up with newer and better ideas. And obviously it's my hope that if we can get enough people reading the book, parents of both college and elementary and secondary school students, that maybe they can force a change in the school system and get these ideas taught.
Well, you know, I got to tell you something, Professor. You have all these new streaming services starting up that all need programming. And as you probably remember, Paul Giamatti did pretty well portraying, I think it was John Adams on HBO a few years ago. So maybe you should shop it to them, and they maybe like it, and you could crack out a miniseries about that. I think that'd be great for America. What do you think?
No, I think that would be wonderful, David McCullough. Who wrote a wonderful book on John Adams? Yeah, had his book turned into the HBO series on John Adams, and it was fabulous, and it really, I think, affected the way a lot of Americans understand that period.
Well, Professor, thank you, and good luck, Professor C. Bradley Thompson, Clemson University. Name of the book, check it out. A different perspective here, America's Revolutionary Mind, A Moral History of the American Revolution and the Declaration that Defined It. He says it was based on a foundation of morals, and that's why it worked. Professor, thank you. Have a happy weekend. We do appreciate the time. Thanks.
Thank you so much, Paul.
Thanks.
Bye-bye.
Appreciate it.
You're listening to Connecticut Today with Paul Pacelli on WICC 600.
And now we are here at WICC 600, like Mr. Big Voice just said. It's hour number three of our four-hour get-together. Up and underway here at WICC 600 on your radio and online at WICC600.com. Streaming all over the world 24-7 at WICC600.com. 203-333-9422, 203-333-WICC. Impeachment talk. If you think it's going away, it's not going away, at least for now, probably for at least the next 2 or 3 months as we turn the corner into the election year. Welcoming back a gentleman who we've talked to a couple of times before, former Time Magazine senior reporter, attorney, and professor of political science right now at St. Peter's University in Jersey City, New Jersey, Professor Alan Sanders. Professor Sanders, how are you? Paul here in Bridgeport.
Very good, Paul. How are you doing?
I'm good. Well, for guys like you and I who watch this stuff for a living, no matter what we're doing, and kind of feast on it, live on it 24-7. It's been a very interesting past couple of days, up to and including today. Professor, what did the House, for people who might be still a little murky on the situation here, the last House vote, what did that actually do?
Well, the last House vote basically just set forth a procedural framework as to how the investigation is going to continue. It's not a formal impeachment resolution. The formal impeachment resolutions would, of course, be the articles of impeachment, if any, are produced ultimately by the Judiciary Committee. But this was basically sort of a framework. This is how we're going to proceed going forward. There will first be a public phase in which the committees that have been investigating this confidentially will now have public hearings.
Mm-hmm.
And then on the basis of those hearings, if things should go forward, all would be sent to the Judiciary Committee to determine whether there would be formal articles of impeachment.
Yeah, and I'm glad you outlined that because, you know, you and I both hear people who are not really, Professor, in tune with this 24/7 is, oh, they're impeaching him. And I think a lot of people, Professor, don't understand because of the gravity of impeachment, it's only happened, you know, once before, and President Clinton was not removed. There are very strict procedures, no matter how partisan things are, that have to be followed here.
Well, that's right. Look, impeachment ultimately is a political process, but it's a political process that is patterned after a criminal kind of a framework. So if you think about a criminal situation, a criminal investigation, first, mm-hmm. there is the investigation, which initially is confidential and secret. Certainly grand jury proceedings are secret. And then once there's enough evidence, probable cause is the criminal standard. Once there is probable cause, then it becomes public. And there's a public hearing about that so that the defendant can hear what the charges are. And then ultimately the trial itself is public. Now, again, impeachment is not a formal criminal proceeding, but it's basically patterned around the kind of procedures that that one would expect in a criminal-like setting.
Yeah, and to add even more confusion for some folks, Professor Sanders, but even complexity, they're also hearing about appeals made to courts, to federal courts, to local courts, as to whether or not they have to testify. Then there's subpoenas here. So there is kind of this legal cloud hovering over a lot of this procedure, correct?
Well, that's right, and part of it is confusing because some of the investigations that have been going forward against the president are not impeachment proceedings. They're simply investigation, congressional mm-hmm. investigations. Congress is fully entitled to investigate the executive branch. That's part of the checks and balances in the Constitution. And then, aside from these investigations, there is now the impeachment procedure that is being activated. So you've got these two things occurring simultaneously, and they're slightly different. But what is clear is that the Constitution, when it talks about impeachment, it says that the sole power of impeachment shall reside in the House, which means that the House really is in full control
yeah.
of how it wants to proceed.
And there is, Professor, I'm sure you may have even talked about this in one of your classes. There's that famous phrase, I'm paraphrasing here, but I believe it was attributed to former President Ford, who when asked about impeachment, he said something to the effect of, well, it's whatever the House wants it to be. The idea of a high crime and misdemeanor by the founders is left intentionally vague, correct?
Yeah, that's right. It is vague. And, of course, he was a congressman at the time, but President Ford basically made the statement you said. If you actually go back to the Federalist Papers, Alexander Hamilton, when he wrote about impeachment, basically said, look, it can be done. It's appropriate to pursue impeachment proceedings against a president that abuses power.
Mm-hmm.
And so abuse of power is not necessarily a crime. It's just using the office in inappropriate ways.
Yeah, and I think that's a very important distinction here, Professor. I have friends of mine who are right wing or center right, and they say, well, "What's the crime?" And I basically have to tell them that's not kind of what we're dealing with here. It's like it's almost like being professor in a very exclusive club where the club members, for whatever reason, if they think you are bringing disrespect or ill repute to it, for lack of a better term, they can kick you out.
Well, certainly that's true. I mean, if you take a look at the language itself, it says high crimes and misdemeanors.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you could take that literally and say it has to be a crime, or you can take it saying it, high crime could be a crime. A misdemeanor might simply be, malfeasance in office. It doesn't necessarily have to be a crime. The language is vague. And as I say, the framers, you know, were very much concerned about monarchical power and abuse of the
yeah.
executive power. And so when Hamilton says, you know, it can really mean just little more than abuse of power, I think you have to take that seriously.
Now, the vote, no surprise, Professor, the vote was virtually party line. There were, I think, two centrist Democratic congressmen from districts the president won back in 2016. So when I saw that, no real surprise. Were you surprised at all or not at the vote? Did you think there'd be more people crossing the line or not on this?
No, I think that's quite predictable. I mean, the Republican policy here, or the Republican line, has been, you know, hear no evil, see no evil, speak no evil of the president. That's been quite clear. And I think their basic tactic right now has been to accuse the procedures of being unfair, and they still accuse these new procedures that have now been ratified yesterday as still being unfair. But I think there's great unease in the Republican caucus about the substance of these allegations. And I think the strategy on the Democratic side is to make them feel increasingly uncomfortable. That's why they want to go to a public hearing. And Nancy Pelosi, who is strategizing this, should not be underestimated. I mean, I think she understands that perhaps in the House and probably also in the Senate, there are not enough votes to remove the president from office, certainly in the Senate. But she's eyeing the 2020 election.
Of course,
she's always been eyeing the 2020 election.
I think it's like a boxing mentality here, where you may not be able to knock the opponent out, but you can win a fight on points if you land enough punches.
That's right. I think one should take a look at it more like guerrilla warfare. Can you wear down? Can you wear down the opposition in such a way that the electorate will now say, "Well, you know, let's get rid of this scandal, brushed administration. Let's just get rid of this. It's just not worth it." I mean, I think that's what she's hoping will actually occur as a result of these proceedings.
And that we are with Professor Alan Sanders, Sacred Heart, check that, St. Peter's University, Jersey City, New Jersey, former Time Magazine senior reporter and attorney, giving us a few more minutes of his time. We're grateful for that. On impeachment. Professor Sanders, the one thing that still confuses me, or maybe not confuses me, but holds the intrigue here, is this whistleblower, whomever that is. And I know there's, and people understand there's whistleblower protections, but we're kind of hearing different things every day. Well, today he or she is going to testify in private. Oh, no, it's not going to happen. And then their attorney tells Adam Schiff, well, maybe we will, and then maybe we won't. Correct me if I'm wrong, but I think that's still a somewhat of a wild card here, correct?
Well, I guess it is a wild card. The series of witnesses that have testified in front of the Intelligence Committee so far have basically confirmed the essence and many of the details that the whistleblower laid out. So one has to wonder whether you actually really do need to hear from the whistleblower, because many of the events that he or she related were so-called hearsay. But a lot of that hearsay has been confirmed. And so basically the whistleblower can be just looked on as a tipster.
Yeah.
And if you have actual better evidence than that tip, or confirmatory evidence of that tip, there's really no need to hear from the tipster. So we'll have to see what the Intelligence Committee decides about that. They're extremely concerned that the identity of this person not be released, because, of course, if the identity is released, that could put that person in danger, and, of course, nobody wants that to happen. But also it would put in question whether future whistleblowers would be willing to come forward when they see wrongdoing.
Well, yeah. And
so the committee is very conscious of that.
Yeah, and if you did that, it would be different from, say, the Watergate hearings, which I, remember vividly growing up, part of the reason I got into this business. You know, back then, Professor, people were very upfront. I mean, you had John Dean talking about a cancer on the presidency. You had all these people there. I would imagine if this person does testify in real time, we might be looking at a video hookup, a voice scrambler, a person behind a partition. You're right. It would be pretty tough, especially in this day and age, Professor. You know, we're not in the early 70s anymore in the Watergate area. We're in the era now of instant communication here.
That's right. And, of course, if that person were to testify, I'm not even sure that that person would testify in Washington. He or she might be testifying from a site somewhere removed from the Capitol, just to preserve the secrecy of the identity of this person. Again, for that person's security, but also for the good of the country, so that future whistleblowers do come forward when they see wrongdoing.
Is it key, Professor, for Democrats here to not make it look like they are stifling Republican questions here, and don't step into a trap of when, say, Chairman Schiff would say, well, we're not going to allow that, or you can't ask that. That's a delicate balancing act, isn't it?
Yes, that's a difficult act, and of course, Adam Schiff is a prosecutor, a former prosecutor, so presumably he's well versed in avoiding that trap. But it is a problem, and I think that's probably one of the reasons why they wanted to move forward to public hearings, which is what this framework calls for, so that if Republicans ask for something which the Democrats believe is unreasonable, it will be aired in public, and hopefully, from the Democratic standpoint, at least they think that they can make their case that it is an unreasonable request. But we'll have to wait and see. But I think the transparency element of a public hearing is a way to try and get around that. At least that's what the Democrats hope.
Yeah, and I know Republicans last week or in the previous weeks, Professor, tried to put out the point was, well, they're keeping us out of the room, and they really weren't. Now, it's not a huge room, as I've heard it described, but in fact, in some of this private questioning, there were, in fact, Republican House members in there, correct?
Oh yes, that was really a stunt to grab the headlines for a day. Republicans have been part of those secret proceedings, and they've accused the committee and various people there of leaking what's going on. Nothing stops them from leaking anything.
Yeah.
So it's not quite right that it's been completely secret. It's been secret from the public, but it certainly hasn't been secret from the Republicans or the Republican Party.
You know, Professor, one thing that I wonder, and again, as you said earlier, does Nancy Pelosi obviously pull the trigger on this, or does she look, for example, at a new poll that came out that in five key swing states, you know, impeachment is barely 50-50? I wonder, Professor, if another alternative here may be a censure act, a censure motion, which would be a separate procedure. But I wonder if the Democrats feel that they don't quite want to pull the trigger on this, figuratively here, but they do want to leave some sort of lasting impression. What do you think of that possibility?
Well, everything is possible. You know, she hasn't really said where she wants this to ultimately wind up. She's always said, we'll go where the facts lead us. And that leaves her a lot of room about the ultimate strategy and the ultimate outcome that she will push for. I think right now she is thinking that we don't need to really think about what the ultimate outcome will be. What we need to think about is what the evidence will be. And I think she's playing for that. Will the evidence, as she hopes it will, be sufficiently damaging so that the president's electoral chances and the Republicans' electoral chances will be damaged? Don't forget, there's also a congressional election going on.
Yeah.
Here. And so she's also looking at the fact that many of the Republicans, particularly some of the ones running in the Senate, may be put in a difficult position if they have to vote on the merits of this. So she's weighing all of these factors, but I think the ultimate thing for her is the 2020 election.
Yeah,
she'll
sure.
do whatever she thinks is necessary to support the Democratic Party in that effort of the 2020 elections.
And, Professor, final question. You just touched on it. This, let's assume that they do file formal articles, and if they do vote to impeach, he is impeached, then the ball goes to the Senate, and when it reached that point with Bill Clinton back in the 90s, they chose not to remove him.
That's right. And, if you look at the history of impeachment, none of the impeachment proceedings have ultimately wound up in a conviction and removal of the president from office. But what it has done, at least in three of the four impeachment instances, is it has very much paralyzed the president. So Andrew Johnson was very much paralyzed after that proceeding for him. So was Nixon. Ultimately, he had to resign. And we don't know what Trump will be like. But ultimately, it really does damage the presidency terribly much. The only one who escaped really reasonably unscathed or relatively unscathed was Bill Clinton.
Mm-hmm. Former Time Magazine senior reporter, attorney, and professor currently of political science at St. Peter's University, Jersey City, New Jersey. Always great to have him. Professor Alan Sanders. Professor, thank you. Have a great weekend.
You too. You take care, Paul.
Thanks. Bye-bye. All right. There you go, folks. He pretty much laid it out here. So what will Madam Pelosi do, right? Well, it really is. You know, people ask me about this all the time in person, on the show here, on Facebook. I also say, listen, right now, you may not like it. Right now, but politically, the most powerful person in the U.S. is not, on a day-to-day basis, President Trump. It's not Mitch McConnell. It's not Mike Pence. It's Nancy Pelosi. She really has a very critical decision that she's going to have to make in the next month or so after all this? Do they feel they have roughed up the president enough to keep him from getting a second term? Do they demoralize him? Do they push him to the point where he might resign? Do if his poll numbers start to drop, which I doubt they will, but they'll keep an eye on the independents here. Does this turn into a Richard Nixon situation all over again where, you know, Republicans went to Richard Nixon, said, Mr. President, you have no support left. You must resign or we will remove you.
A place where you can complain freely. In fact, we encourage it. Connecticut Today with Paul Fuseli, WICC 600.
Okay, we're 203-333-9422, 333-WICC for complaints and or otherwise. And State Senator Kevin Kelly joins us, Republican from Stratford. Kevin, how are you?
Hey, pretty good. Yourself, Paul?
Not too bad, Kevin. First and foremost, before we get to the Capitol stuff tonight, we do have municipal elections coming up next Tuesday.
Yes, and I would remind all the listeners that Tuesday is an important day. You should get out and vote, that the polls open at 6 a.m. And they close at 8 p.m. So, you know, this is our opportunity to voice our opinion as to whether or not we believe our local towns and cities are doing the right job.
Pretty simple, right? And I know, Kevin, sometimes these off-year elections, these muni elections, as we call them, are often not as sexy, quote-unquote, as, you know, a presidential race or a race for Congress or even the General Assembly. But, Kevin, you and I both know that some of the issues and policies that are touched on in these local elections oftentimes have more of an impact on voters, at least on an immediate level.
Well, certainly they do because, you know, the government that's closest to us is the one that affects us the most. And, you know, if it's coming to educate our kids or plow the snow from our streets, that's our local municipal government. And when you see what the price tag is on your property, whether it's a car or a home or other personal property, you realize how expensive it is to run municipalities and thereby important to know who's running in your neighborhood and where you should put your interest and vote.
Absolutely. Kevin, one thing I wanted to touch on with you tonight, I'm glad you called. We're hearing rumblings now that, again, it hasn't even fully been released yet, but again, tolls now on the top of the docket again, it seems here. And we had Governor Lamont a couple of days ago trying to do a Kennedy family impression, if you will, talking about, well, it requires, Kevin, a profile and courage to vote for tolls here. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, first and foremost, you know, we got to look at it's the governor. He needs to lead. He needs to come out with his plan and make sure that it's disclosed to the people of Connecticut. Like the governor who has that job, I have a different job. And my job is to represent the 100,000 people in the 21st Senate District, the communities of Shelton, Seymour, Stratford, and Monroe, which is predominantly middle-class taxpayers and working families. And what I do know in talking with my constituents is that their family budgets are getting hammered, that the cost of government in Connecticut, whether it's the local level, the state level, or the federal level, is too expensive for families, and it's making it very difficult for families to live here. And so, you know, before the government puts its hand in our pocket yet again, I think what we need to see is that, you know, the government can be trusted to begin with. And it's really hard to get over that hurdle when the governor, on one hand, swept the special transportation fund, and now on another hand, the money that was supposed to go to roads and bridges and transportation, he's now coming to us and saying he doesn't have enough. So that's a big hurdle. And I think, you know, I'm going to listen, but
yeah.
I think that when you look at what the families in Connecticut are going through, you know, putting another tax on people is very difficult. Particularly for a legislator who comes from Stratford, which was the site of the horrible crash
mm-hmm.
that brought an end to tolls in Connecticut.
I wonder, Kevin, what the political calculus is here, because it obviously doesn't look like anything's going to happen, you know, this month, now that we're in November, and then you're into the end of the year. And then you turn the corner. Do you think the governor and the people who want tolls here, Kevin, do you really think that they think this would be done in an election year next year? Or are they going to do... Does the posturing happen before the 2020 race, and then if the Democrats still have majorities a year and change from now after the elections, then they just say, damn the torpedoes, and do it? Is that the calculus here, you think?
Well, I think at any point, at this point, I mean, next week is the municipal elections, you know, come November 6th, you're into the new cycle. So anything that happens after next week is an election year.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think people will remember and will look at how everybody votes and why they voted the way that they voted. And that's why, you know, you got to know who your constituents are and make sure that whatever is proposed represents their interests.
You know, I had a person who called me in the other day who said something very interesting. They said, you know, you want to sell me, for example, on tolls here. How about, and you and I know this would never happen, but how about a line-by-line, item-by-item audit that could be put on the internet that people could read? For example, Kevin, of the Department of Transportation, how are you spending the money that you already use, which is fine, it's allocated to you, but, you know, sell me on this, show me on this. You know, make believe we're in Missouri, it's a show-me state. Again, it was a good thought. Why can't people log on and read, Kevin, a line-by-line spreadsheet or a budget?
Well, here's the problem. They can do it. There's a state budget. It shows. And like I just said, the governor has already swept the special transportation fund in the current budget. At a time that he's saying we need money for transportation, he took it and spent it mm-hmm. somewhere else. That's number one. Number two, you look out in eastern Connecticut with the Port Authority, there's all kinds of abuses going on. We just saw another report, and yet we're asking for a public hearing on this, and the majority has absolutely no appetite.
Yeah.
And that's where it's, you know, you want to show the people that you're going to take it serious? Well, then open that up. Let's have the public hearing. The people have a right to know mm-hmm. what's happening with the sacrifice. We pay some of the highest gas taxes in the country, and it goes to the Special Transportation Fund. This sacrifice has already been made, and yet it's not being used for the stated purpose. What makes me believe that this new plan, all of a sudden they're going to get this one right and trust that sacrifice is going to be spent where it's been promised? Show me, you know, like you say. The proof is in the pudding.
Yeah,
let's show by conduct, and the current leadership and majority is not doing that.
Yeah, I mean, Kevin, if you or I go to buy a house tomorrow and we apply for a mortgage, what's the mortgage company going to say? Okay, you want us to lend you $250,000? You know, show me, not only show me what you're worth, what are you doing with your money right now? Common sense, right?
Yeah, what's your credit score?
Yeah.
You know, have you been, you know, what did you do? And the same thing here goes with the state. And the past experience has not been treating the people's sacrifice with the trust that it deserves.
Republican State Senator Kevin Kelly. Kevin, have a great weekend. We'll talk to you next week. Thank you.
Hey, Paul, take care.
Appreciate it, Kevin. Thank you.